Three separate teachings of Jesus on power. Are you ready? Matthew 20. Now, this one's a paraphrase of the Message, and the Message is paraphrased enough, so it'll be unfamiliar verbiage. You won't be like the people of the world. They get a little power, it goes to their heads, they end up lording over one another. Then from Mark 12, Jesus' teaching says, now love your neighbor with the same passion with which you love yourself. And then in Luke 6, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. Okay, last week was just weird, all right? So we're going to unweird it a little bit today. So it's not going to be as difficult as inaccessible. I had several of you say during the week, huh? What do you mean two-ness versus oneness? What are you talking about? I'm going to make it clearer. We're doing a lesson on what Jesus has to say about power. In fact, it turns out to be an indictment by Jesus on the way we commonly use power, so we've titled the lesson, The Abuse of Power. Last week, we laid down some of that groundwork, drawing from Jesus' teaching or his prayer in John 17 about us sharing a oneness together, about Paul's metaphor for the we being many being one body in Christ. And then we looked at Einstein's formula that equates energy and matter as though they appear to be two, really being a oneness. So we began to challenge a visceral view of reality that underlies how we do power. And that visceral view is, that common sense view, that gut instinct that we have, is that you are you and I am me, and that we are separate units, that we are different from one another, we are divided from one another. And instead of seeing ourselves in the common way that we do, seeing ourselves separately, we said that there seems to be functioning out there on the reaches of our awareness another way of seeing reality, a way that we recognize ourselves not as a two-ness, as separate entities, but we recognize ourselves as a oneness. I said last week, using the metaphor of light, that light is a wave and light is a particle. And if you are doing a laser, boy, you really need wave light to be a particle. If you're doing some of the other experiments that we do, you really need light to be a wave. But really, we start to recognize that both waveness and particleness are expressions of a deeper reality that we, because we've got these five senses, define as particleness and waveness. But really, light is a singularity that expresses itself in these ways. And I said, what we've done in terms of thinking about our humanity is we've acknowledged the separateness part, but there's a whole other part of being human that is a oneness part that we've ignored. And in ignoring it, because we've exclusively focused on our differentiation, in ignoring it, we've allowed ourselves a model of life that doesn't serve us well. So Bob brought up a practical way that we see ourselves in a oneness. He said, when two individuals get married, they become part of a oneness that is a marital unit. When individuals join together and become part of a oneness that is a family unit. When we join businesses and we become part of a oneness that is the business unit. When we become a society and we join a oneness that is the social unit. But I said, even at a deeper level than that, at a very level of existence, the fact is that you are animated by something that makes life and not life and not life. There's something that makes you alive, and we say that it is the divine breath, that is the very image of God that animates us, and you are animated by the same thing I am animated by. You are made alive by the same reality that underlies both of us, all of us. And so consequently, we become a oneness of this divine essence. The truer depiction of reality, it turns out, is to see ourselves equally truly one as we do seeing ourselves separate. Now, we fail in seeing ourselves as a oneness because of the experience that we have seeing ourselves separately. I think this way, you think that way. I see these things, you don't see them the way that I do. I like this kind of stuff, you dislike it. I believe these kinds of things, you don't believe those kinds of things. And so consequently, we are different, we clash, We differ, we work cross-grain. And so, because of those experiences, we orient ourselves around a world in which we are separate entities, autonomous individual units, failing to see ourselves with the underlying connectedness that makes us all one. And in this separated way, in this divided way, this way of seeing the world, this gets so deeply embedded in our consciousness that we don't even see it as a way of seeing. We simply see it as the way things are. We don't think to ourselves, oh, this is one way of looking at my humanity. We think of it like gravity. It's one of the natural laws, an unquestionable constant. And we just say, oh, well, of course we are separate, and we are separate and only separate. But Jesus intuited a long time ago that there's another way of seeing our basic fundamental existence, that we can see ourselves in a realigned way with more emphasis put on the fact that we are more connected than we intuitively realize. And then I said last week that recently science has given us some language to talk about the same thing. Last week, Einstein told us that the very nature of the universe is a singularity. It is a oneness. We look at things as separate because we've got five senses that measure things these ways. And for us, those are the only five senses there are. So we think that this is the ultimate way in which reality is perceived. And so consequently, what we can see and feel and touch and reason out with our minds seems to be the sum total of reality. But experimentation and theory and mathematical formulas tell us that, wow, unlike the way that we would observe it, unlike the way our eyes see and our ears hear, energy is not really separate from matter. Matter is energy, and energy is matter. It's not true if you've got five senses like we have, but it's true that there is an underlying connectedness that puts these two things that look different as the same. And so we realize what distinguishes separateness is really the descriptors we put on them more than the substantive essence of what is true. Two-ness, science is telling us, is in fact oneness. And that's counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense to us, to be sure, but it's backed up with experimentation. We do these experiments that allow us to see beyond our five senses, and lo and behold, it turns out to be true. We do these mathematical formulas, we do these calculations, we figure them out, and lo and behold, it turns out to be true that the universe is really made up of oneness rather than two-ness. And this was something that was intuited by the teachings of Jesus and Paul and a host of saints and sages, even from beyond our own religious tradition for centuries. So I said last week that Jesus is about changing our reality. When his teachings don't make sense, it may be our perception of reality that is skewed, not the teachings of Jesus that are skewed. If you are not as separate as you think you are, if you are a singularity instead of a duality, then maybe it could be true that enemies aren't enemies, and maybe it could be true that you could love others as you love self, because we are in this connected oneness. So when Jesus says to love your neighbor with the same passion with which you love yourself, and to do good for your out-group, to do good toward your enemy just as you do toward your in-group and toward your friends, those don't make sense in our current framework. In fact, if you live in a separated world, those concepts are dangerous. To do what Jesus says to do would be foolish. It would be rash, certainly risky and unwise. In our current reality, Jesus' way of talking about power doesn't make any sense. But again, Jesus isn't about configuring you to fit into your existing framework of reality. He's about changing the fundamental construct that defines your reality. Well, here's the problem. When we see ourselves in this twofold separated reality instead of as one together, when we fail to see the shared interests that we have in each other's well-being, when we don't intuitively think to care for one another's needs with the same passions that we care for our own needs, When we don't think of one another's passions and interests as just as important as our own passions and interests, when we don't bring the same level of energy and focus towards someone else's dignity that we bring toward our own dignity, when we don't hold other people's needs in equal regard with our own needs, we tend to create a system that I'm going to describe now that uses power to abuse rather than to build. Seeing one another through the lens of this fundamental separateness, we quite naturally fall into a pattern of life that figures out who's on the top and who's on the bottom. We come to a use of power that becomes a zero-sum reality. Every up point that I get has to be measured as a down point for you for things to even out. Every time that I get a benefit, it has to cost you a deficit. It has to work out in order for things to be even. Every time she gets a win, he has to get a loss. And that's just the way our instincts take us when we see ourselves in a separate, divided reality. And it wasn't the behavior modification that Jesus was after. Yes, it's true that behavior change is important. And yes, it's true that when we change our behaviors, oftentimes it will affect our framing view of reality. But what Jesus was after was a superior view of reality. The reality is that we are, in fact, not as separate entities as we think we are. We are expressions of the same underlying entity. We use spiritual vocabulary like the singularity of the body of Christ, the singleness of being the image of God, the singleness of being the human family, all sharing in this one animation of divine nature. And these spiritual terms keep pointing us away from our twofold instincts, and they keep pointing us back toward a set of singular instincts. Separation instincts motivate us to forms of power that are abusive. Oneness instincts tend us to use power in a way that is more collaborative. Now, next week, we'll see some examples of how ingrained into our human experience power abuse is, but also how central it is to most human suffering. This is a really big deal. It's important for us to get this one right. The way that decisions are made in families is often done on the basis of an abusive power system. The way orders are given at work is often done on the basis of an abusive power system. The way that social structures work is abusive. The way that we relate among genders, the way that we relate among races, among economic strata, one group dominates another group. The way that one industry relates to another, the way that competitors relate within the marketplaces, the way that producers relate to consumers. You just pick up the phone sometime and try and call customer service and you realize how power gets abused. And it goes this way all day, every day, power being misused. And it's so much a part of the way that we live, and it's so embedded in a way that we view reality that we don't even know it's going on. Most of the time, we just think this is the way the world is. We might have in the back of our hearts somewhere a wistful desire that things could be different, but when brass tacks reality comes to bear, this is just the way things are. This is the world in which we have to make a go. This is the way money works. This is the way marriage works. This is the way politics works. This is just the way the world works. And we reveal how deeply embedded this is in our hearts and in our consciousness when you look at our vocabulary. We assign meanings to our reality with the words that we use, and we often speak of ourselves as though we are involved in this red tooth and claw reality that is descriptive of the animal kingdom, for example. When we think about power, we reveal what we believe about it when we use words like top dog, as though we live in a dog pack. Or we use the term pecking order, and we find our place in the pecking order as though we are a brood of chickens. Or we talk about getting top drawer service, which means somebody else is out there getting bottom drawer service, or being low man on the totem pull, or we talk about who wears the pants, or we talk about who calls the shots. And in each one of these terms, we reveal something that is our understanding about power. Somebody has it, and somebody else doesn't. One person is on top, another person is on the bottom. One person dominates, another person submits. People are ranked, and everyone knows where they fall in the ranking system. Now, this is a natural outcome when we see ourselves as separate entities. As soon as you see yourself as being divided from, separate from someone else, instead of being manifestations of the sameness, then one sexuality gets to dominate the other sexuality because they're separate, as we saw in the introductory lesson. People have different capabilities. Some people have quicker minds. Others have more methodical minds. Some have higher IQ. Some have higher EQ. Some have more abstract reasoning ability. Some have more concrete reasoning ability. Some are highly intuitive. Some are highly sensory. And in a framework where people are a two-ness instead of a oneness, instead of these differing capabilities serving to complement within the same system, they become a means by which we break apart and fracture and then begin to compete one with another. Because we are two, so now we have to compete. And so consequently, we define something as valuable and then we match capabilities to that value. For example, we've decided that money-making is something valuable, so we take people with money-making capabilities and we match them to that and we elevate that value. We find someone with widget-producing capabilities or managing people capabilities, and we decide that's an important thing, and so we match those people to those values, and when we do, we say nurturing children or teaching young people, that's not as important, so we will pay these people this much, and we will pay these people that much, and then what we've decided is that this will be our value set, this will be the way things work, and then these people get power, and these people get less. And it happens. And it happens all the time in your life, and it happens all the time in my life. And when it does, one person or one group gets favored, and one person or one group gets to accumulate power, and when they do it at the expense of someone else. And we think, well, that's just the way things are. And once one group has power, what happens is their lives get easier. Their lives get comfier. Once one group or one set of capabilities has power and they have the resources that often go with power, they don't have to face the same kind of challenges that other people do. And so life comes easier to them. And so when life is easier for them, interestingly, they're not interested in giving up their perks. And so they work hard to perpetrate the system that afforded them the power. They work really hard to make sure that widget producing and money making keeps being valued and honored, and children teaching keeps being dishonored. And in this way, one person or one group gets to lord over another person or another group. One person or one group gets the easier life, the comfier life, and another person gets to dictate the terms to the other one. And when this happens, we're well on our way to a misuse of power, an abuse of power. In this world, where we're competing to see who's going to be the top dog, how in the world can we love others with the same passion with which we love ourselves? In this world, in which we have the potential of having to compete with one another at every turn, how in the world do we do good for those who are abusing us? Are we to become doormats? Is this what Jesus is asking us to do? Stay within the existing system, but just roll over and let people run right over the top of you. Let inequity go on. Is that what Jesus is saying? You know, you probably feel the same as I do. That just can't be. The problem, that Jesus would indicate, is the framing narrative that you're living in. The problem is what you're spending your energy working toward. Are you working toward coming out on top, or are you working toward changing the fundamental system? Where do your energies go? The two-ness narrative sets up relationships that become asymmetrical. In other words, one person or one group gets to dictate terms all the time. not just some of the time. One person or one group gets to have an easier life or a comfier life all the time, not just some of the time. It's not shared. Relationships don't work the same in both directions. One person or group commands, the other person or group obeys. And it's never the other way around. The obeyers don't, in some circumstances where it's more appropriate, become the commanders. It's always command and obey, this group, that group. One person shows respect or shows deference, and another person expects and receives that respect or that deference, but never returns it. This person or group or this economic strata gets these privileges, and this person or group or economic strata gets excluded from these privileges. This person or group is in the helper class, and this group is in the helped class, and it's never the other way around. And over time, people just get used to this asymmetrical system, and they call it the way the world is. They get used to non-reciprocation, and we settle for a life that has power abuse at the core of it, but we never call it power abuse. We just call it something else. We call it boss or employee, or we call it rich and poor. We call it clergy and laity. We call it husband and wife. We call it male and female. We call it popular kids, or we call it unpopular kids. We call it all kinds of things, but it's a system of competition between two players that live in a twofold reality. And one of the two peoples or one of the two groups wins, and they get the reward of having won. They worked the system using matching these capabilities to these arbitrarily defined value systems, and they say, we get to win, we get to accumulate power, and therefore we get to determine how other people would be living their lives. And one person or one group defines the game, and the others play by the game. One person or group classifies what is good and what is acceptable and what is the right behavior, and the other group behaves accordingly. One person or group is able to create the system, and the other one lives in the created system. So, as long as we have a two-ness versus a oneness reality, we're going to be living in a world of competition instead of cooperation. A system of competition, in turn, tends to create a culture of fear and of anxiety and of insecurity. Well, of course, in this system, it's a dog-eat-dog world, because we're all animals competing in a pack for limited resources. And of course, we're all afraid for our well-being, because the system that we've created is a world that is always locked in struggle, and it's the struggle to be at the top and to avoid being at the bottom. Life that we have created for ourselves becomes a constant contest and a constant struggle. It's not collaborative, it's antagonistic. So of course people feel afraid. The system that we've created on this two view of reality insists that we be afraid. That's what Jesus was challenging. So, what Jesus is challenging is the system that has come from the belief that we are separate. Because the system that has emerged is an awful, awful system. He was describing a world in which we could see ourselves as a oneness with God, as a oneness with each other, a world in which we didn't have to crave our own security, that we didn't have to spend our lives bolstering up our petty little false selves, that we didn't have to gain these small little honors in these miserable and destructive ways, living shallow lives that have been reduced to making it home at the end of the day, having sustained a win. That these lives are miserable ways to live, Jesus is saying. So I say a sharp word at home, and that puts me on top. But I go to work the next day and I get snubbed. Ugh, I'm back at the bottom. I come out on top on a contract negotiation, and it gives me a sense of power, but my time and energy is getting exploited, at work, which seems to take away my sense of power. The takeover of the company leaves me without a job or without health care, or it bolsters the value of my stock portfolio. In one circumstance, I'm a winner. In the other circumstance, I'm a loser. And this, Jesus indicates, is a foolish way to live. So much waste, because we get these precious few days on this earth and we spend them feeling insecure. Nobody feels safe. We may even get more than our fair share of wins, but this system that exists, that we created, will cause us to still feel this high level of insecurity. Because in a competitive environment, once this is the system that is created, one group or one person will inevitably win. One person or one group will inevitably get what they want, and they will get to be at the top, and they will get to dictate terms, and they will gain advantage over the other, and then they will get to pass those advantages on to their children. So it's not enough just to get there for ourselves. Now we have to live out all of the days of our lives doing this, because we've got to give the same advantage to our kids. And what an exhausting way to live. And what Jesus is suggesting is that we change the system, not that we modify our behaviors within the existing one. I'll give you an illustration that came up in the discussion during the first lesson. It's during the civil rights movement. There were two dominant wings fighting for civil rights. One was Martin Luther King's CLC, Center for Christian Southern Leadership, or something like that, and then the Black Panthers. And both of them were at odds with one another over how to proceed, because the Black Panther movement saw Martin Luther King as being too passive, and Martin Luther King had a perspective as well that was contending for nonviolence. And so we look at that and say, well, one group was violent, one group was nonviolent. That's the difference. It really wasn't that. It was really a fundamental framework in terms of how we view power. Here's the way the Black Panther movement viewed power. They have it, we don't. Let's get some guns, we'll get it. So what we will do is we will make sure that we achieve some kind of parity or some kind of superiority through the force that we will bring to bear. And boy, we will get those people scared. Once they're scared, then we will have some power. Martin Luther King had a very different approach and had to do with a different view of the human experience, therefore a different view of the objective at hand. And he, in one of his more famous speeches, said, it's not going to be enough for us to win. Because if we win, all we'll do is just trade places. So we've got white on top and black on bottom now. We'll just put black on top and white on the bottom, but we'll have the same exact system. And he said, that's not what Jesus was teaching us. Jesus was teaching us to break the system. So in one of these speeches, Bull Connor was doing these awful, awful things, and he said, it will not be sufficient for us to defeat him. We have to work for something else. What we are working for is bringing him to the place where he fights for the righteousness of our cause with the same passion that we fight for the righteousness of our cause. Because we're trying to dismantle the system. Fighting for the change system says, as long as we acknowledge that there's a two-ness, somebody's going to be on top and somebody's going to be on the bottom. But if we come to the place where we see ourselves as part of the same whole, then it won't suffice for one group to be advantaged and the other group to be disadvantaged. That just won't suffice. We have to work for a sense in which this is good for all, not just for some. So, even if we win, if we don't change the system, we lose. Even if we get to dictate terms, even if we get to be on the top, even if we get to gain the advantage, we lose, because the system creates anxiety, the system creates fear, the system creates this always possible reality of a reversal of fortunes. The abuse of power in our two reality is a losing proposition for everybody that's involved. And Jesus figured this out a long time ago. So if you go to business seminars, as I'm sure many of you do, you hear a lot of talk about, a lot of talk that's informed by the oneness view, because the oneness view is a very important part of our humanity. So you'll hear talk about cooperation and collaboration and creating win-win scenarios. But as long as we try and work in the realm of these surface realities and don't go to the core of our belief reality, as long as we are seeing ourselves as separate entities, we will remain in competition one with another. And as we are all competing for the scarcity of love or the scarcity of dignity or the scarcity of respect or the scarcity of rewards or comforts, even with our best intentions for cooperation, even with our best intentions and having read the greatest business books on creating win-win scenarios, all of our efforts will continue to get derailed and bad apples will continue to rise to the surface and get to run things, and our effectiveness at gaining win-win will be very limited. Because what we need isn't better effort in the old system. What we need is a new framing reality that creates a new system. This is what Jesus was after. And this is what our efforts on the earth are to be focused toward. We need Jesus' narrative and Paul's and Einstein's. But what we saw during that series that I did on the clutch of death, framing narratives don't change easily. Ours is a democratic nation. So if anyone should I have a changed narrative, it should be us. Ours is a society that has this strong value in egalitarianism. We teach our children that in America, anybody can become president. I mean, if they're born here. Anybody can succeed. Anyone can thrive if they'll just work hard. But as precious as an ideal as that is, it's not really how things work out. Here's just a simple example. Kids that get SAT training do better than kids who don't get SAT training. But SAT training usually costs something. It costs something in terms of property taxes, or it costs something in terms of outside tutoring. Now, those that don't get SAT training but have innate perseverance, they will still succeed. Those that don't get SAT training but have a lot of ambition, they're still going to succeed. But when all things are equal and faced with a tougher path, the kid that doesn't get the tutoring is going to tire out sooner than the kid that does, because he or she has a harder path to walk. And so consequently, because he or she tires out sooner, he or she is going to plateau earlier. That's just the way things work. And that happens in all kinds of contexts in 100 different ways. People who have a harder path get tired earlier because it's harder. And the people who don't have the benefits and don't have the comfier life and don't have the advantages, they get wearier earlier. And when this happens, when we don't get into this school or that school, when we don't get this job or that job, when we don't get this economic reward that we had hoped for, it begins to affect how we think about ourselves. Now remember, we live in this egalitarian democratic society. But it affects how we think about ourselves, and we begin to think of ourselves as, I am a cog in a system, and this is kind of where I fit. This is where I am in the pecking order. I'm not really a dominant player in this. Well, I'm not really at the bottom either, but this is kind of where I am. And we define self on the basis of where we plateau out. And as soon as we do this, we have created, not externally to ourselves, but within ourselves, we've created the pecking order of dominance and submission. And even living in a democratic society as we do, and even living in a society that values egalitarianism as we do, we frame our worlds in terms of who should obey us and who we should obey. Who should honor us and who we should honor. We're on the top, and we know we're on top of these, but we know that these are on top of us. And so we are looking for who is the one I am responsible to? Who is the one that I am to obey? Who is the one that I am to honor? To whom do I defer? And who will defer to me? And if someone doesn't treat me right, who's working in a grocery store, I think of myself as I am the customer and I am the paying one and you should treat me this way. But in turn, it doesn't always reciprocate and go back the other way. Well, I am a minister, and in some circles, I rank very low in the social ranking system, because in many circles, ministers are dismissed and marginalized and looked down upon and devalued as ignorant or as backward or as some kind of derogatory thing. But in other circles, I'm doing all right. I hold the very authority of God. People look to me to be the holy man, a conduit of divine power over all of life. So in some circles, I could command deference, while in other circles, I command scorn and derision. And it's no different in your world. You know where you are in the pecking order. In one circle, you're at the top. In another circle, you're at the bottom. Because the system that is built on this idea that we are a two-ness instead of a oneness is just that way. You will always find yourself in some context where you are either in a position of dominance or you are in a position of submission. One way that you will be at the top, one way that you will be at the bottom. And once we buy into this system, that's the system we live out our lives in. We only get one life, and that's the way we spend it once we buy this system. And Jesus was challenging the system. Now, when we are in this system and we've sold it to ourselves, sold it to our very hearts, and sold it to our very heads, then one group of people will draw from the gifts that they have and become dominators within the system. They want to extend their profile by lording it over as many circumstances and as many people as they can. They want to extend their sway in the world because that's what their personality lends them toward. The other temperament will find submission to be easier, so they even expand themselves using that which they have at their disposal, so they submit to the dominant person's world, and they find a role in this other person's power structure, and consequently, they get to share in the honor, and they get to share in the rewards, and they get to share in the prestige that comes from this other person's, and so we live our lives making it work for us within an system that is just the way the world works. And that's the way it works at RTP. That's the way it works at the state capitol downtown. That's the way retail works. It's the way manufacturing works. It's the way education works. It's the way engineering works. It's the way families work. It's the way churches work. It's the way friendships work. It's the way marriages work. And Jesus was contending, it is not that way for you. Unlike the rest of the world, it will not be your way to lord over one another. Yours will be a higher life. Yours will be a better life. And what we need to have our vision of reality elevated. What we need is to see what Jesus saw, to see what Paul saw, to see what Einstein saw. That in many ways, our separateness is not the defining characteristic of our lives. In many ways, the vision of separateness that we have is an illusion. That a deeper truth and deeper reality is that, yes, we are differentiated one from another, that's true, but we are also of a singularity. We are of a oneness. And that actually is the truer, deeper reality about us. We are not separate entities in competition. We are one body. And it doesn't make any more sense for us to harm one another on our way to the top than it does for the leg to harm the arm on its way to getting its preference. It doesn't make sense to do that. But that's the way our instincts go. And our instincts need rewiring. We need to see fundamentally differently. And then our instincts need to be rewired so that our instincts don't take us in the midst of an argument with our spouse to try and lord over and win. Because if we win, we don't win. It will take some rewiring of our instincts so that we don't feel so afraid and so insecure and live our lives on the basis of those fears of this two-ness competitive world in which we live. We need to have our vision rewired so that we don't spend our lives so diligently working to get ours. That we begin to see win-win as a normative way instead of a rare thing. We begin to realize that ours is to work for the good of all. Ours is to work for the good of the common good. Instead of just contending for what's good for me in this separate little entity that I believe myself to be. And we do that not because it's noble and good and we ought to and we should. We do it because it's true. We do it because that's the way reality is. And when you live according to a realer real, and when you live according to a truer true, it works better. Because that's a more accurate explanation of the way things are. That's a better reflection of the truest form of truth. So, we pause right there. Next week, I told you when we started the lesson that we would spend some weeks looking at the problem, and then we'll look at how Jesus framed the solution. We're still going to look at the problem next week, and next week I'm going to talk about some of the common ways that that the power abuse framework just works out in our everyday lives because we hardly even see it for what it is. So, Spirit of God, I pray that we would have elevated vision, that we would see our oneness together, that it wouldn't be just inaccessible words, but it begin to seep into our reality, that we would understand that we are of a oneness. And I pray that we would have rewired instincts and that we would use our power wisely and purely and helpfully. Be it so, Lord. Amen.